Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Limitless Living for Women podcast with your host here, Pam Fontas. Today, we are kicking off a two-part series that I am super stoked about. What is it that we are going to talk about? We are going to talk about our relationship to fitness. You heard me right, our relationship to it. Our relationship to how we move our bodies, why we move our bodies, and this is just such a juicy topic that I'm pretty stoked to jump into. So I'm not gonna keep you here in the intro any longer. Let's get going. Part one, here we go. So maybe now you're wondering, who is this gal to be talking about our relationship to movement and fitness? And sure, maybe some of you or many of you tuning in know that I have been a fitness professional now for almost two decades of my life, working with thousands of women and even men at one point too. So yes, of course, my professional career has led me to a lot of insight around this particular topic. But what part one today we are going to be discussing, and I'm going to be sharing actually, is my own story and my history when it comes to movement, fitness, sport. Yeah. And why are we going to do that? To be honest, not because I feel the strong desire to share it, but I think what ends up happening when I share this story is you come to understand perhaps a little bit more about my lens, my beliefs, the work that I do currently and why I do it. That is, yes, of course, driven by personal experience, but also research and science, right? This isn't just, I don't do the work that I do just because of my own story and my own history with how I have moved my body. Of course, there's so much more to it. But what I just really wanted to do is share a little bit of my story today. And not only because I think it sets a good foundation for part two and the things that we're going to be discussing, because I know full-heartedly that a lot of you tuning in will hear or see pieces of yourself when I share different parts of my story. And of course, you may not relate to all of it, and maybe not a lot of it, maybe some of it. Some of you maybe have had very similar experiences, but as always, I hope this is a podcast where often you can feel really seen. And I have a feeling that by sharing my story, you might see a little piece of you. So I'm going to dive in here and give you kind of the running history on Pam's relationship to movement and fitness and sport. And I think by sharing my story, you'll have perhaps a better understanding of my professional lens and my take on how I choose to show up in the fitness and wellness industry and coach women. And I just think it'll serve as a really good platform as we move into part two and hopefully give you some good things to think about. So let's stop chatting about why I'm doing this episode and get right into it. Okay, but also fair warning that I'm totally recording this podcast with the patio doors open and birds chirping in the background, and I could like feel Mother Nature flowing into my home because that's just so necessary after having been cooped up way too much over the past year or so. So yeah, if you hear some birds chirping, some dogs barking here or there, that is why. And you know what? Maybe some professional podcasters will be like, no, Bam, you're supposed to like isolate and turn off all the outside noise. And I'm thinking, well, if this episode is going to get done, this is how it's going to get done. So be warned, Mother Nature is like flowing in and around me right about now. So I thought, how do I break up or even explain or, you know, share my life when it came to movement and sport? And I thought, let's put it into chapters. All right. So chapter one is childhood and what movement and sport looked like then for me. when I was a little Pammy Fontas. So, you know, I've been told that the Jolly Jumper, for those of you who might know and remember, the Jolly Jumper was my favorite thing. My mother would say if, you know, she needed me distracted or happy, she'd stick me in the Jolly Jumper and I would jump in it so long that often I would put myself to sleep in it. And apparently it just made me super happy. So yeah, we're going back to before I could walk. Apparently I loved movement and high intensity movement. For those of you who are like, what is the Jolly Jumper? Just Google it. I'm sure you could find it. You basically stick the baby in there before they can walk and they jump. And that's, I guess, the first form of movement that I fell in love with, or so I have been told. Now, I love looking back at old photo albums, which, by the way, photo albums, huh? I just started thinking, we don't have enough of them anymore because I think we do things so much digitally. So on that note, I miss photo albums. Now, back to the old photo albums. I can't tell you how many pictures there are of me joining my dad in his post-workout little exercises in our basement in our old home, childhood home, where I grew up. So my dad was always into sport and fitness, and I vaguely recall memories. I'm probably like two or three at this point where dad would go for a run or workout and he'd come down in the basement to like finish up his exercise. And I just thought it was so cool. And there's like pictures of me in my little onesie, probably because I'm pushing bedtime at this point, but just wanting to hang out with dad and do the little exercises, whatever he was doing. So I just smile thinking about it, and I could only imagine how my mom was feeling trying to get me to bed, and here's the 2 or 3 year old like jumping up and down, probably generating more energy than what she wanted. But oh, I'm smiling. Can we rewind sometimes to take us back to childhood? Anyways, so little Pammy loved movement. There's pictures of me like hanging upside down on climbers. And you know, during gym time or outside, I can like visually picture, there's one picture of me where I'm literally hanging upside down on a slide. My hair is everywhere. There's like, the climber is full of boys and it just looks like I am just owning my body and my life and just loving myself. And that picture makes me really happy because, as you know, we'll continue on in the episode, this like little girl who had such a zest for life and movement and like no shame about her body. Well, you know, it didn't last my whole life. So it just makes me happy looking back at those pictures. Anyways, this little gal in childhood loved movement. And then there came the world of sport. So I was in senior kindergarten, confirmed by my mother today before I recorded this podcast, when I was like, sign me up for soccer. Soccer, I would argue, would be my first love ever. And it happened at the ripe old age of 5 or 6, I guess, whatever you are when you're in senior kindergarten. And yeah, I can vividly remember how much I loved it. Soccer nights weren't my favorite. My mom said I just like lived for soccer nights. I would be found in my extra time kicking the ball in the backyard with my dad. I loved the game and I wanted from a young girl to be smart about the game. Like I wanted to understand the game. My mom said I was a little observer. I wasn't just kicking it to kick it from a young age. I really wanted to understand the world of soccer and I just fell in love with the game. So childhood soccer and Pam went hand in hand for sure. I loved soccer nights. I always remember each summer knowing what nights were soccer nights, and those were always my favorite days as a kid. And if you didn't find me playing soccer, I was probably on a bike with my neighborhood friends or running around with my sister. Like I said, hanging upside down on climbers. This little kid just loved to move. Maybe there was a bit of TV in my really young early childhood years, but oh man, if Pam could do anything, it would be moving as a kid. And I just loved it. And as the childhood years progressed, you know, movement and sport definitely was a focal point of my life. I do, however, remember pretty, I don't want to say vaguely, but I remember in grade four, I can still vividly remember this. This was actually my first year in a new school, and we had gym class, and now gym class had introduced a gymnastics type portion, I feel. And I can remember now suddenly there was a girls' and a boys' locker room. And I can picture literally being in the locker room, in the girls' locker room, getting ready for gym class. So this is probably the first year that, you know, you had to start changing for gym class. When you're younger, I don't think you change for gym class. You just did whatever activity in your day-to-day clothes. And I remember she was like one of the really cool, pretty girls in the class, wearing something that was more form-fitted. Now suddenly girls were wearing more the kind of like one pieces or whatever it is, you know, tight, more tight-fitted clothing so that we could do gymnastics. And I just suddenly remember around that age, so of grade four, we're talking 9 years old, that the female form suddenly was something to consider as we moved. And there existed an ideal form, right? That there was suddenly talk about our bodies and who had nice or good bodies. Like this existed in the girls' locker room in grade four. I can't remember specifics, but I just remember it coming to the forefront. So I'm still here being this active girl who loves sport more than anything, but okay, suddenly I'm very aware that the world is maybe liking girls to look a certain way, especially if they're going to wear form-fitted things as they do physical activity. So, okay, the messages start around then. Grade five and six, I still remember that's when basketball. So basketball would be my second love, I'd say, got introduced into my world. We had a league back in my public school called Hoopsters. And in, I think it was once you hit grade five, you were allowed to partake. It was always on a weeknight as well. And you were put on a basketball team, skills and drills. And then there was a game, and little athletic Pammy just also fell in love with this game too. And again, the skill behind the game, like I wanted to nail down that shot. I wanted to nail down my foul shot. I wanted to learn and be able to kill those three pointers. I wanted to understand the game. I didn't want to just run and move just because it was an activity. Like I was like, I need to be good at it. So not gonna lie, but as you're noticing the trend here, I was competitive. And my competitive nature definitely in sport, I can remember it from childhood, right? So I'm totally owning, I just didn't want to be another player on the team. I wanted to either be a top scorer or have a strength in a particular element of the game, be it soccer, be it basketball at that time. So I wanted to move, but now as I'm growing and, you know, into later childhood, my competitive nature is coming out a little bit more. I'm not okay with just being part of a team. I definitely want to be someone who's impactful on the team. You know, we could get into the whys behind why was all these things, but like I said, I'm just sharing my story here. I was a competitive little one. I wanted to be one of the best players on the team. That was just how it was going to go. I wasn't okay with not. And I remember from a young age being super hard on myself if I didn't score lots of points that game, or if I just felt like one of the average players. Like it was not something that ever settled with me. So yeah, childhood summers, I remember it's either on the soccer fields or shooting baskets in my driveway. Like I wanted to improve my game in sport. I was very motivated by that. I was motivated by the finish in basketball. I was motivated by setting up a beautiful shot in soccer or taking an awesome corner kick. Like that stuff for whatever reason motivated me and I wanted to improve on it. So movement became a lot about performance, I'd say, around those years. I wanted to have a strong level of fitness for the game specifically, and I wanted to be good at the game, both soccer and both basketball. So now we're like around grade six at this point. And that's childhood. That's childhood chapter. I was a little girl who loved to move, then who also fell in love with sport, soccer, my first love, basketball, my second, and movement. The focal point around it was I really wanted to be good at the game. And, you know, it wasn't outside pressure. I mean, my dad grew up loving sport, but he never forced it upon us. And never made me feel like I had to be the best player. My mom was super supportive. She was she was the mom. She's going to kill me. She's listening. But she was the mom that when I was little, oh, I have to share this Tula story. Tula is my mom's name, by the way. Demetra is her Greek name, but we call her Tula. That's a whole other, I don't even think that'll ever be a podcast episode. But Mama Tula is my mom, just so you know. Anyways, but I'm just thinking, and I have to share this. When I was young, like we're talking 5 and 6 and 7 and really into soccer, Mama Tula was like the loud, cheering, awesome mama on the sidelines who was so into it. But then like one day at the grocery store, someone recognized her as the mom who cheered really loud. Anyways, I think like then maybe she didn't cheer as loud, which makes me a little bit sad. But anyways, basically what I'm trying to say, I had super supportive parents and they were never the ones that made me feel like I had to be the best in the sport. Like for whatever reason, again, we could go to, this is just a whole other different topic, but that definitely, that pressure was very internal. Like it was me. It was the voices inside my mind that made me feel and desire and need to be one of the top players on any team that I played on. So childhood, let's wrap that up. That is chapter one. Okay, chapter two, adolescence and teen years. Oh, this is a goodie. Oh, but a goodie, but lots of pieces to this story. Now, as I kind of move forward into chapter two, I guess a piece of chapter one that I needed to speak to that probably made more of a profound impact in this chapter of my life is my friendships and my circle of friends. I was not alone in being this little girl who wanted to really perform in sport and athleticism. My closest and best of friends lived the exact same life. And when I say the exact same, I mean, they were the ones in the driveway shooting hoops, kicking the soccer balls, doing wind sprints for fun in those years. And, you know, one of my closest friends, and still to this day, one of my childhood best friends, we actually, the first time I met her, as I had mentioned earlier, I started at a new school in grade 4. And what I didn't mention is up until then, I was like one of very few of the female athletes, like, you know, in gym class, or even at recess time, it's like everybody lines up and there's like two captains of teams and you pick people on your team. Like if there was a girl being chosen first, it had been me up until this point. And in grade 4, now suddenly there was this blonde haired, blue eyed, beautiful girl named Leslie in the class next door to me who was giving me a run for my money. And she was getting picked first at recess time for the sport or for the teams. And I was like, huh, now, needless to say, she's still one of my best friends to this day. But I think it's just important to share that, you know, I wasn't alone in this world of wanting to be competitive and good at sport. And when it came to basketball or soccer, my closest friends, I guess my tribe in childhood, into adolescence and my teen years were very driven by similar things. So the girls and the teens and the women closest to me, or I guess, yeah, girls and teens, we're not women yet, but yeah, they felt the same. So I think it was important to share that piece, is that's also the people that I had really connected with and that I was surrounding myself with during those years. So moving in here, adolescence and moving into the teen years, you know, what's kind of starts happening here is that the level of competitiveness in sport increases. Okay. So now suddenly there's OBA. I'm on an Ontario, on a team that plays in the Ontario Basketball Association. So we're competitive in basketball. We're traveling. OVA, Ontario Volleyball Association, in grade 9, me and my best friend Leslie that I mentioned earlier, and another good friend of ours, Kate, were also on this team. So now we're traveling and playing competitive volleyball. I'm on so many different soccer teams. So What's really interesting about this time is that the level of competitiveness in sport is increasing, and performance is becoming that much more important. However, simultaneously, the messaging about how we should look as women and what our body should look like, and that we should actually put in the work to shrink it and work on it, also becomes really strong. Like, I mean, this is going hand in hand. Early teen years, and honestly, I'm going back to grade seven. So grade seven, that's the year you turn 13, I think. I can vividly remember, you know, wanting to score the points, the goals, play the sport, but then being in my bedroom at night, like doing leg lifts or crunches or just something, you know, a form of movement that I thought was, okay, there's sport and then there's movement that's going to maybe help my body look a certain way. Like, it's interesting. There was two different voices that I had to listen to. It's like, do the suicides, shoot this many hoops to practice your corner kicks, make sure you're super good at this, but also don't forget, you know, you've got to keep your body lean and slim, and it's desirable if it looks a certain way. And remember, all of these things are really important too. So it's like the world now is like, it felt a little bit conflicting. I don't know if it was conflicting or if it felt like a lot. It's like, okay, now suddenly movement's getting a little bit more complicated. Okay. So we're not talking, it's not about just practicing shooting hoops or kicking the ball in the backyard with my dad anymore, or hanging upside down on climbers. It's, oh, movement. I'm getting these messages that can also help me look a certain way. And on top of this, I'm supposed to look a certain way. And so how do I pull this all together if I want to be a really good athlete, but I also need to look a certain way? So the complicated relationship of mine with food and exercise definitely started in end of grade seven, seriously much more in grade eight. I can remember it. Like I said, this episode is about my physical activity history, so we won't get into too much of the disordered eating behaviors, but of course they came a little bit tandem and hand in hand. But I guess, you know, early childhood, there was movement just for joy and pleasure. Then suddenly became the world of sport. And as I mentioned, as I was getting more competitive, performance was an element that drove me when it came to move my body. And then suddenly in these early teen years and adolescent years, as much as the drive to perform also existed as a reason for me to move my body, now suddenly I had this other drive to engage in exercise or fitness as a way to control or shrink my body. Like, I can honestly remember doing suicides. I can even picture myself in the gym for basketball, and I was happy that the coach asked us to run more suicides because, you know, my 13-year-old mind back then thought, perfect, I'm burning more calories, this is good exercise. It's like, this is interesting, you know, suddenly performance and exercise and sport all kind of got mumbly jumbly for me. And that's where a little bit more of a complicated relationship to movement, I guess, began. And so, yes, I'm still this competitive athlete in my high school years, definitely driven by trying to be one of the top players on any team that I played on. Same thing, my closest friends were on these teams with me. We were traveling on weekends constantly for basketball, more or less. Basketball was the one that had us traveling. My nights would be filled with soccer. Kingston opened their first indoor soccer dome in my high school years, so I'd be playing indoor soccer. I remember one of the teachers at our school pulled me up to play tier one, I guess, in Kingston in the women's league when I was 15 or 16. So I was like the baby of the league, but I was obviously keen and gung-ho. So yeah, my world existed around sport, but sport was definitely just one way also to start now manipulating my body or to see it as a form of exercise that would maybe help my body shrink or look a certain way. And I would say that all of that got brought to the next level in grade 11. I can vividly remember was the first year that I got a gym membership. And I could remember my friend at the time that it was her boyfriend was older. And so he had a car, he could drive, we couldn't drive yet. And every day after school, if there wasn't like a practice we had, or practice would be probably later for a sport, we would get a drive to the gym and we would work out. You know, we would get on those cardio machines for however long and maybe go try some weights, but I can't really picture us doing too many weights. Like I'm really, really remembering the cardio back then because again, we both had goals of shrinking our bodies and that's how we thought would be a good way to go about it. And of course, what happens is we start to get applause for being the gym goers. We start to get applause for the shrinking bodies. We, you know, suddenly this is becoming, you know, something that is celebrated at the beginning, of course, right? Like it's seen as, ooh, they've got willpower, they're motivated, they're, you know, making their bodies more desirable. And yeah, the unhealthy addiction to exercise most definitely continued. And I mean, let's talk about it. The teen years are tough enough as it is. And when you're getting the messaging that it's really important for your body to look a certain way and you want it to be desirable. And like, we won't even get into the whole, like, as a young girl wanting to be desired by other boys at that time was obviously a thing too. And, you know, the media let me know how I was supposed to do it. That's for sure. Like there was the cultural messaging that wasn't saying, you know, be a thick, strong girl and the boys are going to like you. Like it was like pretty plain and simple. Like you were in those years. So, I mean, high school for me was late 90s, early 2000s. And it was plain and simple, like be skinny, be thin, shrink. That's what was admired. And you know what, like I said, whether it's the truth or not, and that's what the boys were thinking, that is definitely what the cultural messaging was. And I definitely took that to heart. And that was, I would be lying if I said that wasn't important to me during my teen years. So what just starts to end up happening by the end of high school is that burning calories now suddenly are getting much more prioritized over sport. And my love for the game starts changing because I become so driven by trying to attain a certain body ideal that I suddenly, for me, sport in my mind starts to get in the way. You know, I view basketball and soccer practice as not the most efficient way that I could be burning calories. You know, I should be on a treadmill or on an elliptical or whatever it is for a certain length of time instead of having to be at this basketball practice or, you know, running these like soccer skills drills that just are not making me move enough, right? And so, you know, I can remember even in grade 12, we had a great soccer team. Ugh, I was a LaSalle girl. I was a Black Knights. If you're listening in Kingston, Ontario, proudly, I'm owning it. We had great teams during my high school years, but I still remember me and a good friend of mine was the goalie. Okay. So she wanted to go for a run before the game. And she's like, you know, she was the same friend that I went to the gym with after school. And like, let's take off for a long run before the game. Well, I was center midfield. And if you don't know the game of soccer, center midfields run. They like run all game. And I was also the girl who didn't like subs. I didn't want anybody to take me off the field. I wanted to stay on the field. So like, that's 90 minutes of running. But somehow I had it in my mind that because it was so much stop and go, it would just make sense to take off for runs with my friend that was the goalie before the game. And, you know, I can even remember mentally in grade 12 playing sports. And I had so much anxiety over the missing time at the gym or the fact that particular movement I felt wasn't going to get me working on or closer to my body ideal that I became almost resentful of sport. You know, I became the girl who in grade 9 loved volleyball and was like a strong power position to I can picture in grade 12 just being so aware of how I looked in my spandex shorts and the size not being small enough and, you know, just like serving the ball into the net because I was so preoccupied with my body, what it looked like, what I wanted it to look like, what I should be doing in the moment for it to look like. And so, I'm even talking about it now, friends. I'm like, it breaks my heart because just think about this. Just think about that little girl who was so excited about sport and movement and performance. And just, you know, if you ask me what my dream was as a little girl, I was like, I wanted to be a girl that played World Cup soccer. I want to be a girl in the NHL. And now suddenly, because of the messaging of the world, I became this girl who didn't play basketball in her final year of high school. Why? You want to know why? Because she chose to run cross country. You want to know why she chose to run cross country? Like, hello, I was not a cross country runner, but cross country practice meant running. Running meant burning calories. Okay, sign me up. Like, my heart just breaks. It's, you know, I didn't fully do my whole OAC year. So there was no opportunity to give my final high school year in soccer. Volleyball was out of the question too. In my OAC year, sport was gone. Now suddenly the only reason that I wanted to show up and move was to burn calories, keep shrinking my body. Of course, yes, simultaneously right now, my disordered eating is at a peak. And so the amount of calories I was ingesting was a ridiculously low amount. And I was just completely consumed with movement being a way to get to my desired body, which of course we know it's like, that's a never ending battle of itself. When do you even get to that desired body? So now in chapter 2, we are in my OAC year. By the way, OAC is grade 13. So for those of you tuning in that are like, what is she talking about OAC? Maybe you're someone that never had it. That was grade 13. And on that note, I was the last part of that last crew that had grade 13 here in Ontario and Canada. So that's what I mean by when I'm referencing my OAC year. So thought I'd clear that up for a moment. So, you know, we sit here in my OAC year. So basically I'm graduating high school. The pressure is on for where am I going to head to university? You're applying for university. Eating disorder is at its peak. Full transparency. I had all the signs and symptoms of a pretty severe eating disorder that year. And exercise addiction was a big piece to it. And, you know, another heartbreaking story for me anyways, when I look back, is I had some soccer coaches who were connected with coaches at McGill University in Montreal, which is actually, so I had accepted to go there. I had been accepted to be in commerce at McGill, that for the following year to start my university chapter. And a coach of mine in soccer and a teacher at my current school had connections and was trying to open the door so that I could play varsity when I moved on to university. And McGill had a great team, great coaching staff, and that would have been an amazing opportunity. And I'm not going to lie, that all I could think about was there's no way that I could play varsity sport. It would take away from gym time. I needed to put in gym time. I knew university was going to come with lots of pressures and it was that much more important. I kept on my gym routine. So I didn't allow my coach and my teacher to explore it any further. And I just said, I refuse to play varsity. My dad, I remember being really supportive and encouraging, you know, to play a varsity sport. And it was not going to be an option. And, you know, at that point, honestly, friends, I was burning the candle at both ends. I was at such a peak. I had definitely hit peak and I don't know, peak, let's call it rock bottom when it came to my disordered eating and the exercise addiction. It's almost like there was no way I felt like I could take anything else on. This life that now I've had created for myself, this hamster wheel of movement being just about calories and counting every friggin' morsel that went into my mouth, had just become all consuming, you know? So the toxic relationship with movement and my body and eating began at the ripe old age of 12. And now I sit here at like 19 years of age and I've definitely hit rock bottom and thought, I can't keep doing this anymore. And that was the turning point. Often, I mean, how many stories do we hear like that, right? It's like once you hit rock bottom, there's nowhere to go but up. And really, that's kind of the only option that I had. Up was not easy. But I will say that a teacher, a high school teacher who had such an instrumental or such a just a big impact on my life when it comes to health and wellness and movement and cultivating a more positive relationship to it. I was blessed and grateful that she reached out in high school. And as someone who had navigated disordered eating herself in her younger years and exercise addiction, she saw it in me and she held space for me so that I could at least even talk out loud about these things. And she was really instrumental in my healing, especially in my early years. And what I did, why I did want to bring her up right now, because now as we move into adulthood, the adulthood chapter of my life and movement, it starts messy, but it gets really positive. So that's the good part, right? It starts, adulthood started, my rock bottom exercise addiction, disordered eating phase. But it leads into also one of the most beautiful chapters of my life. So here we go, adulthood. So I'm 18, about to turn 19, about to start university in just months' time. My birthday is in April, so a couple months left until summer hits and then the university chapter begins. And at this point, finally, after however many years of living secretly with an eating disorder and using exercise in a very addictive and certain way to achieve certain body goals, I finally admit to having a problem. And that if anybody out there, I know this could be a bit of triggersome content if you've struggled with an eating disorder before, or have had anything that you've kept hidden, finally acknowledging out loud that it is a problem is a pretty, I don't know if it's powerful, but it can be a turning point that doesn't necessarily happen right away, but just acknowledging something is wrong when for years it just was your way of life is something that happened for me when I was 18, about to turn 19. And of course, the first person that I was able to admit that all of these things that I had been talking to her about was actually a problem was the teacher who, graciously would meet with me once a week just to hold space for the challenges that I was navigating. And I'm forever grateful for that. Anyways, rock bottom moment. Not only now have I admitted a problem, I'm basically admitting to myself, like, there's no way I can continue to live my life this way. That's how rock bottom we are. And my body's about as small as it could probably get in its form anyways, without getting too sick. I'm using a various amount of eating disorder behaviors, which I don't want to talk about as I just know that they could be triggersome for people, but basically any disordered eating behavior that you could look up, I was engaging in and just realized like that's it's not realized, but I couldn't do it anymore. Physically, my body couldn't do it anymore. Mentally, I couldn't do it anymore. I just didn't even know how I was going to show up every day anymore. And so there needed to be another way. And so I was desperately trying to seek what this other way could even look like, having only known what I knew for so many years now. And this particular teacher, who acted very much like a role model and was instrumental, as I said, in kind of my early stages of like healing my relationship with my body and food and exercise, she was an example of someone who I saw as being on the other side. She empathized with where I was, having had disordered eating behavior in her history and exercise addiction. But now suddenly, she was the teacher at our high school that did the fitness conditioning for the boys' football team and was like, people thought how cool it was. She could like do clapping push-ups. Like she was so physically capable and it was celebrated. And that suddenly, like that became I was like, this is interesting. This is really cool. And the more I got to know about her and where she was at with having a positive relationship to her body and fitness and such in the moment, I'd be completely honest and transparent. I looked to her as perhaps ways for me even to get this journey started, because I felt so lost. And a beautiful thing that came into that, it became because of this, was an introduction to strength training. Because we're going back now, 2003, friends. So 2003 would have been my graduating year from high school. And it was, as I said, simultaneously my rock bottom moment when it came to all of this stuff. But she was probably the only woman at that time that I knew strength trained and picked up weights for the reason of getting stronger and performing in a certain way. And as scary, I'll be really honest, as scary and scary and scary as that felt, I still remember to choose to do a resistance workout over a crazy amount of cardio. I remember the one time when I went to the gym, one of the most tremendous positive impacts on my life. I can remember, you know, I was quite sick at the point when I wanted to try and change things. And when I thought, okay, I'm going to start to see what maybe the body can do, and I'm going to go into the gym and do some weights instead of staying in the cardio room. And I can still remember, you know, the chest press machine, like you're literally sitting upright and it's machine and you push the weight away from you. I remember that was one of the first things, like I felt more safe in machines. And of course, as this girl who's feeling really insecure in this weight room and has only moved in a certain way for so long, it felt safe to try that out. And I still remember, pushing 10 pounds away from my chest felt so hard, like so hard. And that just gives you an idea of where I was at in terms of my strength. And listen, ladies and gentlemen, anybody who's listening, like the chest press machine, this isn't the same as like pressing 10 pound dumbbells. Like this is, you're upright, you're pushing the weight away from you. I can guarantee that most of you can sit on that chest press machine and push a substantially amount more weight. And like, just to give you, so anyways, I knew I was weak. I knew that things needed to change. I didn't know how, but I was game to just try something different in my life. And honestly, touching iron, you know, the term that we use when we say touching, you know, getting in the weight room really, really helped to spearhead some powerful life transformations for me. What happened through my healing and starting to allowing myself and giving myself permission to move in different ways, because holy moly, was that ever something that was really hard. I'm not going to lie. Like at first, even when I did do in the weight room, I was definitely jumping back into the cardio room. Healing was not an uphill journey, but what I loved about strength training and getting back in the weight room is because suddenly I was like, okay, cool. Let's make my body stronger. Let's see what my body can do. It kind of reconnected me to the kid in me who was really wanted to practice her basketball shot in the driveway or be smart on the soccer field or have a good kick. And that I wasn't doing that then as a kid to try and look a certain way, right? And so suddenly the weight room could give me this place at that time where I could try and focus on becoming stronger while trying to let go of the messages of attempting to keep shrinking my body and only doing it for that reason. So yeah, it was really powerful to have that introduction to strength training that teacher in high school gave me at the time. Like I said, back then, yes, of course, women fill weight rooms now and strength training is so important. And we know that for so many reasons, but back then I was one of very few, if any, sometimes in the gym, in the weight room, right? So it also could feel very empowering, right? And as someone, again, who had a bit of that competitive side, shocking, I wanted to lift weights and I wanted to understand how to strength train and how to do it well, right? So yeah, that kind of, that spearheaded my healing. That same year, within that year, I ended up dropping out of McGill University Commerce by the time I was like a month and a half into the program, actually getting, committing to working with a therapist to heal through my eating disorder. And then, as many of you have heard in my various talks that I've given, I think I even said this in the first podcast, is that year, when I was 19, was when I put pen to paper and said I would only keep going on this healing journey if I could take other women with me. So that year, basically, I'm in therapy. I'm starting to move in different ways. To be honest, my body was like a disaster from so many overuse injuries that I actually was, whether I wanted to or not, I was also forced to move in different ways as well. I couldn't just run for hours anymore, do cardio for hours. My IT band, my right side, my body was just saying F you to all of that. So not only was I forced to move differently, I also started to really want to move differently because I knew I just couldn't do what I used to do for so much longer, right? And at the same time, friends, as I was making slow, I would say slow, they were slow behavioral changes. None of this was easy. This is really just a quick snapshot in this podcast episode, but as I was slowly making the behavioral changes to be a stronger, healthier, and happier Pam, I really wanted to understand why the F did this young girl who like loved her body and movement and sport and life, how did she end up in this rock bottom place where, you know, calories and getting the body as small as it could be and exercising for the only reason to keep shrinking my body and feel shame if I walked out of the house in anything but a size small or extra small. Like, how the hell did I get here? You know, and I became really, really angry. And if my friends around that time probably would know, my mom and my sister can definitely remember, I just started researching a lot, reading books, The Body Project, I remember being one of them, The Beauty Myth, I remember being another one. Like, I can literally picture myself in my childhood home, you know, that I'd moved back to after dropping out of university and while I'm working with a therapist and trying to make all these changes, and I would read these books and I would make notes. Like, I'm not making notes for anybody else but myself. Like, there's no teacher marking these, but I was just reading and just trying to understand and go, what systems were at play here that made me feel the way that I did about my body? And so, you know, the cultural messaging, of course, I was becoming that much more aware about. And I was so pissed. I was like, okay, I was like mad. I was like, my eating disorder and this exercise addiction took so much away from my life in those years. And oh no. Oh no, no, no. I do not want you to do it again. And listen, I was angry. I was also the girl still healing and recovering and still being triggered in many different ways. It was just all a messy journey, which I would argue that still some days it's a messy journey. But yeah, I was just like, I was not having it for women. And as someone who not only wanted to change for me, like I said, a big part of my story was when I put pen to paper on a day that I was struggling in my journal, and I said, I'll only keep going if I could take other women with me. I was like, I don't want women feeling like this way. This is bullshit. Like, when I say I was angry and feeling all the feels, like, I was angry and feeling all the feels. So the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, any of you that are listening right now, is I put a high level of responsibility on myself that if I was to get into the fitness and the coaching world, that I would not be someone who would support the messaging in making women play small in their lives, like show up. And when I say like playing small in all the ways, playing small with their voices, playing small with their bodies, playing small with how they showed up in the world. Like, I did not want to be that trigger for women. So through that year, you know, I'm moving my body now differently. I'm going, holy shit, this is really cool to feel myself getting strong. Because of course, the body image stuff, yes, to get healthier for me did mean that I needed to gain weight at that point. It just did. It was non-negotiable that that was going to happen for me because of the rock bottom that I had got to. So over the course of the year, of course, that was something that wasn't easy during recovery to, you know, make peace with the weight that I was gaining. But because I was getting stronger and I suddenly was like, oh, cool, my body can do this. My body can lift this amount of weight now. Like, you know, the 10 pounds goes up to 100 pounds within like months. And that was so cool on that chest press machine. You know, that day, maybe the pants were tighter. I'd gone up in sizes, but like, cool, Pam, you know, you nourished enough and the body can do that. That was really transformative for me personally. And of course, like being someone who was not only driven personally because I wanted to heal, but very driven because I wanted to help other women too on this journey and not feel that way, because I know how horrible it can feel to just put all of our self-worth on our body size. And because that's literally where I was. All of my worth was completely associated with my body size. Any raking moment of the day was associated with that. And whether I was moving and how much cardio I did and how much calories I burned, like that is literally where I got all my worth at one point. And that is a horribly painful place to be. And I just didn't want that for women at all. I also knew that being in this place would hold me back. Like, think about this, ladies, like all of the time and energy we put towards feeling like we need to change our bodies and or feeling horrible about our bodies and or feeling horrible about if we worked out or if we didn't work out or how much we worked out or what size we are or any of the stuff, like any of the time and energy we put towards like hating our bodies or, you know, striving from a place that lacks more self-worth to like change our bodies. Like that is just taking up time from living. That is taking up time from making change in the world. That is taking up time from living your own best life, however defined by you. Like it's, yeah. And so I jumped into the fitness industry like 2 feet in, so excited about the work. I ended up studying kinesiology at McMaster University. I minored in psych. That's a piece of my story. I knew, you know, from 19 years old, I'm like, it ain't just about the physical. I knew from then because of my, of course, my own personal experience, the physical and fitness was not just about the physical and fitness when it came to coaching and working with women. I just knew that. And so I jumped into the fitness industry. So now I'm at McMaster University. I've become a certified personal trainer. I'm working towards my certification in group fitness. Of course, I'm still one of few very girls in the weight room because now this is what, 2004. And I am just I'm excited. I'm excited about my career and what I hope to help women. I'm now excited that I can wake up and not even think about counting calories again, or worry about calories. I'm happy that I'm in a place that if I don't work out, I'm not hating myself. I am in a relationship with my first love, who I actually met at the gym while I was strength training. So that's, I guess there's the positive thing that came out of getting into that weight room as well. He was super supportive too on my healing journey. He was really instrumental in those early years as I was finding myself. You know, I mean, this is a topic for a whole other episode when we talk about love and our first loves and everything. But, you know, for me, my first love was someone who loved me before I even knew to love myself. Right. And so having someone in my corner that I could be really honest with about where I was in my healing journey, in my eating disorder recovery, meant more than I really can even put into words in this podcast episode. But so it was key for me to have very supportive people that I could be real with around me in those early years of recovery. It was really important because I was still very vulnerable. So as much as I was this girl who was like wanting to be this powerhouse going into the fitness industry, and And I felt very strongly in how I showed up in my professional life, for sure. I did not want to be a trigger for any of these things when it came to the women that I worked with. But it didn't mean that I wasn't still vulnerable and triggered. And healing wasn't all uphill, right? It was messy. So yeah, having those support systems, including him during my university years, was super important. So now, as we're getting deeper into the adulthood chapter, you know, behaviorally, I've healed a lot. I'm not over-exercising. I'm getting enough nutrition and nourishment and not being restrictive. I'm in a much healthier place. That doesn't mean all of the demons in my mind are gone, but as you know, I think the truth of the matter, and I think something that still remains true to this day, is that my work helps keep me in my integrity and helps remind me about my why, my own personal why, my reasons for showing up in the world as Pam in all different elements of my life. Because yes, there's obviously, you saw within the last however many minutes here that I shared, there was quite a positive transformation. You know, I went from rock bottom in my life with my relationship to movement to now suddenly thriving a bit more, for sure. And, you know, my university years were filled with teaching group fitness classes everywhere, from kickboxing to step to high low to boot camps to core blasts. I became a spin instructor. I did one-on-one training. I ran and developed the Women on Weights program at McMaster University. Like I was loving working in my industry. I really was. I was loving being a part of the what I felt was the solution and what I felt was a much more empowering way for women to show up in the world. The thing is like I said, friends, we're going back now 2004, 5, 6, my university years there. And I was quite a lone ranger in the fitness industry at that time. I mean, now we have social media that's filled with, you know, people who coin themselves as body positive influencers and, you know, practitioners that help women with intuitive eating and, you know, fitness influencers who very much influence fitness in this positive and empowering way. And not only about shrinking the bodies, like, yes, I'm so happy that there has been movement in that direction, but rewind, you know, that many years ago, and I was quite alone in my messaging. But the thing is I couldn't do it any other way. So what was interesting is when I did start my career in fitness, and which was simultaneously at the same time I was starting university and also being one of the only handful, if even handful, of girls in the weight room, I was questioned, you know, a lot. However, what was really interesting was I don't know if I viewed it as an experiment, but I was like, hang on. Fitness professionals want to sell and market and motivate in a certain way, in a way that I feel is very like shame-based driven, you know, make women feel horrible about their bodies now. And so that's how we sell them the package. That's how we sell them the training. That's how we motivate them in class to work harder. Like, I was very aware that that was the messaging of the industry that I was in. It was everywhere. But I was also, like I said, I had committed to myself that there was no way in freaking hell that I was going to be part of this oppressive system and make women feel horrible. However, like we've talked about, I'm pretty competitive and like being really good at what I do. And so that definitely was something I carried with me as I started to work in the fitness industry. And it's like, I wanted to prove that I could be more positive and empowering with my messaging and also fill the classes and also sell out the one-on-one roster list and like do really good work in the industry. And, you know, I can look back proudly and say that worked. I had full classes, people who would say they were motivated like crazy to work hard or show up or try the thing or become stronger or do the workout when I was at the front of the class or when I was working with them as their trainer. And I didn't even have to outwardly say that I was attempting to motivate maybe differently than how other instructors or trainers were doing it. It's like, I kind of wanted to just test an experiment. It's like, fine, my industry tells me that I'm supposed to motivate people this way by telling them they need to get ready for bikini season and by telling them they need to focus on burning calories or shrinking their bodies and blah, blah, blah. But based on my own experience and what I know and how oppressive I feel that that is, there's no way I'm going to sign up for it. And really cool, because my career in fitness, I feel quite proud of. I've filled classes, I've filled programs, and I've always done my best to do it in a place of integrity. Now, don't get me wrong. Do I think that I've always been as inclusive back then as I am now? No, we keep learning. And when we know better, we do better for sure. But if I understood that something was going to be harmful for a woman, even if other people would tell me it would make me an extra dollar, get me an extra client, I refused. There was no way I was going to be part of that system or play part of that game. And like I said, it's not because I was completely healed and on the other end and standing on the top of this hierarchical ladder, or standing on the top of this hierarchy, you know, I'm at the top and I'm feeling all body positive and feeling great about myself every day. No. But I just was committed to not being that for other women. And I love that I proved the industry wrong in my early years. I'm not going to lie. I look back now and I was like, it was really, I wouldn't say uphill, but I got challenged a lot. I remember meeting new friends and girls looking at being like, oh, why do you lift weights? Like almost confused. One of my best friends still to this day. I kid you not, what was really interesting is that this was first year university and we're just getting to know each other. And that question basically opened up me becoming vulnerable and honest about my story and my path that led me to why I was one of the only girls in the weight room, you know, that day when she was asking me why. And we have a beautiful, wonderful, amazing friendship still to this day now, however many, 17, 18 years later. And because I chose to share my story and kind of my why for being the girl that showed up in the weight room and doing the thing. So, oh, there's just so much I could say. I mean, the fitness industry, I can't say it was the easiest place to jump into as being a woman who was healing from exercise addiction and, disordered eating, but you know, there's a bit of stubbornness to me and a little bit of competitiveness to me, as you might get from earlier in the episode. And as someone who honestly just genuinely truly cares and also had her own rock bottom moments because of a toxic relationship to fitness, I just was able to keep driven because of that all. You know, friends, as I wrap up sharing about this final chapter of my life, adulthood, so from my early 20s until now, honestly, I could say so much, and this podcast episode could probably go on for days if I dug deep into every chapter of my life and talked about, you know, my relationship to movement and fitness and sport in all of the ways and shared all of the things. And you know, what are really key things that I want to share about my relationship to movement in the past, I guess, decade is that I have now come more to a place in my life where movement can mean and be motivated by so much more than just looking a certain way, which is really empowering and really supportive, especially when we're navigating challenging times as we all have been in this past year. The other thing is I just want to highlight and I just want to say and completely be transparent that it doesn't mean that I don't still struggle with body image stuff. It doesn't mean that sometimes those thoughts about shrinking the body or changing what it looks like to feel better about myself don't ever exist. No, they do. I'm being completely honest. I'm a woman living in 2021. And of course, that stuff can definitely exist. The difference is now, majority of the time, when I choose movement, I choose it from a place of worthiness. When I choose movement, I choose movement that I know is going to make me feel a certain way. When I pick up a weight, I know how powerful it could feel. when I go on a walk, I'm not thinking the only reason or even the reason that I'm going on the walk is to try and get in a certain size of jeans. And I'm not judging all of those things, please. So if you're tuning in, and I don't judge, I'm not here to judge the reasons why people move, right? And why fitness is a part of their life. And to be really honest, I think I'm in a place right now where I call myself in this place of like renegotiating my relationship to movement, you know, and how it's going to serve me right now in this chapter of my life. I'll be transparent. There was a bit of ego in the last decade or so at different times for me when it came to movement. Yeah, think about it. I was the competitive athlete. Okay. Then toxic relationship, then to exercise. Then suddenly I found the weight room. So yeah, for sure. At one point, it was quite important for me to be the strongest girl in the weight room, or maybe be stronger than everybody if I was in the front of a group fitness class. 100% that did exist at one point, for sure. Non-negotiable. But that ego has definitely burst in the last, I'd say, 5+ years. Where that isn't as important to me. It's that stuff is still there. You know, I still have that competitive nature. But, you know, movement, how I see movement now and how I even coach movement now is, man, oh man, is it ever a powerful tool to help women connect with themselves, to a tool to help us show up for ourselves, a tool to help us cultivate certain feelings that we want to feel both in our bodies and in our lives. You know, I've had a great conversation with Jesse Mundell that you're going to actually hear in upcoming, a couple, it's like 2 or 3 episodes down the road now. But, you know, when I coach women right now, when I say it ain't just about the physical, I couldn't mean it more. Fitness and movement, it's like it's this launching pad to help women step more into their power and help women show up for themselves more. And so that is how I use movement in my work right now. And if I'm being honest, I think that's how I'm using it in my life in this moment, is every time I choose to move, it's just reminding myself that I'm choosing to show up for myself in this moment, right? For me right now, I'm doing some challenging workouts these last few weeks. And as I'm moving through the challenging workouts, I'm thinking through the challenging things that life has handed me in the past year and that I was able to make it through. Like, a movement can just be so powerful when it's just not used for solely being it a tool to help us shrink our bodies as women, right? Like, it's a complete, very powerful tool. And I know, listen, this is a podcast for women. I work with women. So yes, this is what I'm speaking about. But of course, it is an extremely powerful tool for men to use too. And listen, I'm not speaking here that I am against people who use movement for aesthetic changes. I'm not judging it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I think we all deserve autonomy over our body and the decisions that we make with our bodies. But my goal for myself and my goal for my clients is to get moving from a place of worthiness, that we are worth touching the iron, putting the running shoes on, going for a walk, going for a run, you know, hanging upside down on climbers. I had to throw that in. You know, like, it's, we are worth moving in a way that the young child in all of us used to move. Right? We are so worthy of that. And so even on the days that I struggle, I commit to being part of the solution and not what I feel is part of what can be a very problematic system that encourages women to move and take part in fitness only for the sole reason of looking a certain way. I won't be a part of that system. And not only because of my own story, but now it's almost 2 decades later in the industry and there's proof in the pudding. You know, I feel very passionate about why I do what I do and even how I do it. You know, I've been able to get women to places of feeling powerful and great and strong and wonderful in their bodies. And I haven't had to do it how traditionally my fitness industry has told me that I should be doing it. I do not need to make women feel horrible about themselves to get them to move. I do not actually believe that that messaging is supportive for us to, is supportive in us showing up to move for like a lifetime of wellness and a lifetime of fitness and a lifetime of movement. And so, you know, I wrap up the relation or this episode by saying, where am I at currently when it comes to movement? I'm at, honestly, moving because I feel worth it. I'm at a place where I even want to try new things because I just want to be explorative with movement again. And I have fun when I move. I choose fun music when I do workouts. I use movement to heal sometimes. I use movement sometimes as a way of working through my feelings and my emotions. I am far from perfect when it comes to how I feel about my body every day, but honestly, I am proof that movement can be done from a place that's much more sustainable and enjoyable and consistent in our lives. And movement can be a very empowering tool to help us live our best lives as defined by us. And not only am I proof, I have clients that are proof, and I have some tips and tricks and tools and supportive ways of being and thinking and showing up in the world that can help you as the listener get there too. And so, you know, I wrap up this episode by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to my story and pieces of it. Know that I most definitely couldn't share everything, but hopefully you get a little bit of glance into my history and maybe why I show up in the industry like I show up in the industry right now. And I'm really excited for part two of this two-part series because we are going to start talking about how we can all move towards a more sustainable and enjoyable and thriving relationship to movement and fitness. So if you are in this place of, I don't do it enough and I feel guilty, or I know I'm obsessive and I just can't stop, or you're somewhere in between on that continuum, just know that it is possible. I know it as a professional. I know it personally to get to a place where movement can be fun again, you know, and movement can be done as an act of showing up for yourself in an empowering way, not as an act to try and shrink your body and to try and shrink away from this beautiful life that you've been given. It is possible. Friends, thank you so much for being here for episode 3 and traveling down my little past journey of my own relationship to fitness. I hope maybe there were spots where you saw or heard pieces of yourself, or maybe it just makes you that much more interested in what's to come for episode 2 and just gives you an understanding of why I do the work that I do. And speaking of the work that I do, the last couple weeks has been pretty exciting because 2 weeks ago I launched the LL Sisterhood, which is an online fitness and coaching membership for women. Women anywhere in the world can take part, and I'm so excited about having birthed this baby because for so many years, it's like you could only get fitness coaching from Pam if you lived in Kingston, Ontario, and now you can get it on demand, a click of a button away, in the Limitless Living web app, and I'm pretty pumped about it. So ladies, if you are listening and you want some motivation for some amazing workouts that you can do at home alongside an amazing community, check it out. The link is in the description in the podcast episode, and I would be super pumped to welcome you. The sisterhood is growing, and I'm so excited for all to come. Anyways, can't wait to see you in part 2 of this 2-part series next week when I give you the tools, tips, and tricks to move towards a much more positive relationship to fitness and movement.